I'm Angela Kenneke, and this is Grieving Out Loud, a podcast dedicated to one of the biggest crises facing our nation, the deadly drug epidemic. A record 112,000 Americans have died in the last 12 months from drugs alone. That's about 307 people every single day. Today's guest, Natasha Combs, feared she would become part of that statistic.
In the last year, I've lost six of my friends to drug overdoses. And a lot of it comes down to just treatment not being accessible, the care that they need not being accessible.
Natasha struggled with substance use disorder after a surgery where she was prescribed painkillers, coupled with the fact that she was battling extreme grief from losing her brother, mother, husband, best friend, and grandmother, all within a short period of time. Now, that's enough to break anyone. But here's where Natasha hoped her story would take a turn for the better. She realized she needed help and checked herself into a treatment facility.
And you found out you were fired while you were in treatment.
Yeah, so I was officially fired 10 days after I went to treatment. Nobody told me. I got a letter in the mail. And when somebody had brought my mail while I was in treatment, all the letter said was that I was no longer employed.
Now, without insurance or a job, Natasha contemplated leaving treatment, but at the same time, she feared if she did, she would relapse. That's when an Emily's Hope treatment scholarship came into play.
So just knowing that I don't have that financial burden and that, you know, I have a roof over my head and things like that is life-changing, and it saved my life.
You also have the power to make a real difference and save lives. Explore our podcast show notes to find out how your donation can transform someone's life through a treatment scholarship. Stay tuned as we delve into the program and discover how Natasha's journey has inspired her to give back and make a real impact.
Give me some of your background. Like, how did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, so I was adopted from Russia. I lived in an orphanage for the first 18 months of my life. I knew very little about my biological mom. All I knew was that she was a drug addict and alcoholic. And then I was adopted by a family here in South Dakota.
Natasha's new family resembled what many consider a typical American household. Her dad was a doctor and her mom worked at a bank.
They both worked 9 to 5s, were home every night. I played sports in high school, played sports in the summer and things like that. And I mean, I really had your typical life growing up. And so I was raised with them until the time that I was 12. And then I went to inpatient treatment for the first time.
At age 12?
At age 12.
What happened at age 12?
I started drinking at the age of 11.
Eleven years old may seem very young to start drinking. But research from Columbia University reveals that the average age at which a teen boy first experiments with alcohol is 11, and for teen girls, it's 13. What's particularly alarming is that studies indicate that alcohol use during adolescence can interfere with the normal adolescent brain development and increase the risk of substance use disorder.
One night, I was at a friend's house, and she was like, "Hey, like, my parents have beer. Do you want to try it?" And I was like, yeah, sure. I knew that, like, my parents had talked to me about addiction being a disease that runs in families and things like that. And with my biological mother being an alcoholic and a drug addict, my parents had told me. So I knew the risks. I knew what I was doing. I mean, as much as my 11-year-old brain could comprehend. And I just remember having this beer, and it was the greatest thing that had ever happened to me. The feeling that I felt relaxed, and I felt like I could accomplish anything. And so I kind of would, you know, sneak those alcoholic drinks and things like that. And then when I was 12, I actually got drunk and almost drowned in the lake in our backyard. And had my friend not been there, I would have drowned in our backyard. And that was kind of where my parents, I think, realized that there was an issue. I was having behavioral issues in school. I was acting out in school and doing things like that. And I was going to counseling. And I remember my parents just talking to my counselor and my counselor being like, yeah, this isn't normal. Like, we have this idea that teenagers drinking isn't this crazy thing. It's normal. They do it. But I was so young that they were like, this is an issue. And so I spent 2.5 years in residential treatment for just different behavioral problems and things like that. And then when I was 15, I went back home to live with my dad. My parents had gotten divorced.
At first, everything seemed to be going well. Natasha successfully gave up alcohol. But a few months later, she encountered another setback when she tore tendons in her wrist. Doctors recommended surgery, and that took her down a challenging path.
And so I went to an orthopedic surgeon, and they were like, we're going to cast it up. We're going to do a very small minor procedure. And then they gave me opioids to take home. The first time I'd ever had morphine was in the hospital after surgery. And I just remember laying there, and that whole feeling that I felt when I was younger came back. And I was like, this is good. This is what people want. This is why they give you the drugs when you're having surgery and things. And I was immediately addicted. There was a girl that I went to school with who, her mom had some sort of painkillers for a back problem or something. And she would just bring them to me. And it went on for about 6 months. And during this time, my life just fell apart. I was depressed. I was angry. I was acting out. I was lashing out. My grades were failing. I'd always been a good student. I went on to graduate high school a little bit early. But it was just this new feeling, one that I had never, ever felt before. So I went back to treatment when I was 16. And during that time, I got the help that I felt like I had been looking for. People listened to me. People heard me. We talked about alternatives to drugs and things like that and coping skills. And so I stayed clean out of high school, started college, things like that.
And you basically hadn't been on any substances between the age of 16 and 22?
No, and I didn't even drink. Growing up, watching everybody drink so much, knowing my history, I had made it very clear that I didn't even want to drink. I drank on very, very rare occasions.
During that time, Natasha also had a firsthand look at the harsh impact of substance use disorder and mental illness. She very vividly remembers the moment when her parents delivered the heart-wrenching news that her brother died from a heroin overdose.
When I was 17, I was in inpatient treatment, actually. I was really close to leaving. And I just remember the whole weekend being this weird blur of events. I got a call from my mom, and she was acting kind of weird, and then everybody started kind of acting weird. But I didn't really think anything had happened, at least nothing bad. And then my parents came to visit, and I knew immediately when I saw my parents get out of the vehicle together, they'd been divorced for years at that point, and that something bad had happened. And I remember my mom just crying, just sobbing, and she's like, he's gone. He had died of an overdose, and it was believed that it was intentional, that he didn't want to live anymore. And that was the first time in my life that I really saw the effects of how bad mental health can get and how bad addiction can get. And so I spent the next couple months, really, it was at 17 years old, it was the first major loss that I had gone through in my life. You know, our siblings are supposed to grow old with us. And I just remember my family was different after that. My mom was always a person who kept it all together. And it was the first time that my mom and I sat down and we talked about how serious drugs were and how serious it is to be a drug addict. And I remember my mom, shortly after my brother died, being like, I don't want this to happen to you. But being 17, I thought I was invincible. I didn't care. And I grew up. I mean, I knew people who had died of an overdose. I had a friend in high school whose sister died of a drug overdose. And so, you know, we had the talks at school. We talked about these things. I knew how serious it was. But I just figured that I was untouchable. You know, I could stop when I wanted to.
When Natasha turned 22, life threw another curveball her way. She had to undergo yet another surgery, this time a hysterectomy.
I kind of casually mentioned it to my doctor that I had had some issues with opioids in the past. And my doctor was like, okay, I'll write you a small prescription. And then I took them again, not knowing how easy it was to fall back into that. And that kind of just started this spiral of when the prescription ran out and I went back to my doctor. You know, my doctor filled it a couple more times and then they were like, we don't think you need this anymore. And that's when I started buying it off the street.
Natasha initially relied on prescription painkillers she bought from a friend. But as life dealt her multiple heart-wrenching losses, she found herself searching for something more.
The summer that I was 22, my mom died. We didn't have the greatest relationship, but it was one of those things where it was permanent and that was the end. My mom had just died. I hadn't even gone back to work yet. And I got a phone call that my best friend had committed suicide. And my whole world shattered. My life fell apart. I ended up quitting my job. I met a guy who sold drugs. And, you know, it started with things like marijuana. And then one day he was like, I think you should try heroin. I was like, great, give it to me. At that point, I had no will to live. I had no will to really do anything. And I was hooked. I used it one time. And for the next 2 years, I did it every day.
Tell me what about it hooked you. Explain heroin, how it feels, what it does to you.
I felt like I didn't have to worry about anything. I didn't feel anything at all. My body was numb. My feelings were numb. I would go just day to day and life was okay because I didn't have to deal with anything.
Was life okay?
No, not at all.
What was happening?
So I was grieving a lot in the 6 months after my mom died, my best friend died, and then my grandma died. And then about a year after that, my husband died. And so in that year, from 2020 to 2022, it was just loss after loss. And I felt like I was barely hanging on and I didn't know who to turn to. I went to therapy twice a week. I saw an addictions therapist. I saw a mental health therapist. And I tried the things. You know, I tried to do it on my own. I tried the cold turkey. I tried to stop. I wanted to stop. And I just couldn't.
How did your husband die?
Car accident.
Car accident. Okay. Wow. That's a lot of loss.
To try to cope with all that loss, Natasha says she used heroin every day for a year and a half. It wasn't her intention to resort to illicit substances, but her addiction had a relentless grip that seemed to pull her deeper with each passing day.
How do you go from taking pills to smoking marijuana to, you know, intravenously using heroin?
I watched YouTube videos. It was all my drug dealer had available. And so I think I went to Google and was like, how to shoot heroin. I think that was what I put in the Google search. And I just started watching these videos. And there were videos where people would walk you step by step where to tie your arm off, how to insert the needle, what to do with the needle when you were done with it, exactly how much to give yourself. And I was able to watch step-by-step videos that told me exactly how to get high. And I was like, well, if it's on the internet and people are going to show me how to do it, it can't be that bad. And I think I was naive the whole time of how bad and how serious addiction could be.
Did you ever worry about fentanyl or dying during this time?
I had a friend who was like, people are mixing fentanyl in with drugs. Like, people are dying. And she was really worried. And I was just like, I mean, if it happens, it happens. If I die, I die.
Explain that to me, because people watching this won't understand that.
I had given up. I had absolutely no will to continue. And in fact, it came down to I didn't want to hurt the people that I loved. I isolated myself from everybody that I loved. And I remember a really close friend of mine, after I got sober, coming up to me and being like, we were all worried that one day we were just going to get a phone call that you had died. Every time we didn't hear from you for a couple hours, we would, you know, I'll call each other and see if anybody had heard from you. And, you know, anytime you would leave your house, we were worried that you weren't going to come back. And it got to the point where I couldn't hold a job down. I was working in the mental health field at the time. I was getting my master's degree, in criminal justice. I worked in the prison during my active addiction. And I worked with people in the mental health field.
Those things don't jive to me. That's like a contradiction.
And it was because I was so passionate about helping other people. I didn't want anybody to feel the way that I did, but I had given up on myself. I didn't really care how I felt anymore. I had no will to do better.
Were you able to continue to go to work and to do all those things?
I missed a lot of days.
Not only was Natasha frequently absent from work, but her coworkers and clients couldn't help but notice her changing behavior.
I had been working at the place I was working at for about 5 months, and I was working with kids. And I went into work one day, and a kid that I was working with looked me in the eyes and was like, "You're high right now." I remember stopping and being like, "What? No, I'm not." I was like, if this kid that I work with sees that, everybody sees that. A couple of days later, my boss called me into her office and was like, "Hey, like, we've had this report." And I was like, "No, like, not at all." And she's like, "Well, are you willing to take a drug test for us?" And I was like, "Yeah," because we'd always done it at a different office. We'd go to a clinic and do it. And I was like, "Yeah." And she hands me a cup as I'm sitting there. And I was like, "Oh, like right now." She's like, "Yeah, like we have test strips. We can do it right here." And I walked out. I quit my job that day. I didn't say anything to her. I walked out. Obviously, they knew. And I woke up the next day and just started applying for different jobs. And it would come to these points where people would start to get suspicious, or I would start to miss a lot of work, or I had all of these excuses of things that were going on in my life. And I just bounced from job to job. When people started getting suspicious, I would just find a new job.
What prompted you to get help?
So I was sitting in therapy one day, and I remember the first time my therapist mentioned it. It was about 4 months before I actually went and did something about it. It just kind of casually mentioned that I should look into inpatient treatment options or outpatient treatment options or just really any sort of treatment options. And I laughed at her and I couldn't stop laughing. And she's like, "What's wrong with you?" And I was like, "Treatment's for people who want help. Treatment's for people who want to get better." And I started like casually just thinking about it. She'd mention it every session for a little bit. You know, I would continue to not acknowledge that she was talking about it. And then one day I was sitting in her office and I told her that I thought my addiction was going to kill me. She was like, "There's options. Like, you can get help. We'll do it with you. We'll walk you through the process. We'll help you fill out the paperwork that needs to be filled out and things like that." And I just couldn't do it. And I was driving home that night and there was a child in my back seat. And I broke down and I realized that it was going to be a situation where my family was going to lose me or I was going to get clean. That was the moment where I went home that night and I really looked into treatment options and I started discussing with my therapist the steps that needed to be taken to get treatment. And one day I called and I was like, "Hey, I need help. I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know what the next steps are, but I can't live like this anymore."
A week later, Natasha began inpatient treatment at the Avera Addiction Care Center. Since 2019, Emily's Hope has helped more than 200 people at the center pay for treatment through scholarships. These scholarships are financed by people like you who donate money to help others who are struggling. If you'd like to donate to help people like Natasha, please check out this podcast show notes or visit our website, emilyshope.charity.
And I remember laying in like the detox portion and I had tested positive for every substance that you could possibly. I mean, there was amphetamines, there was opioids, marijuana. I mean, everything that could be tested for, I tested positive for. And it was one of those things where the only drug that I knowingly knew that I was taking was heroin. So seeing my drug panel, they're like, "Did you know?" It's like, "No, I had no idea."
In today's illicit drug supply, that's not unusual. Drug manufacturers are mixing the powerful synthetic opioid fentanyl and passing it off as something else in order to enhance their strength and lower production costs. In fact, earlier this year, the DEA issued an alert regarding a significant nationwide surge in the deadliest of counterfeit prescription pills laced with fentanyl. Shockingly, 7 out of 10 of the tested pills contained a potentially deadly dose. We've delved into this issue on multiple episodes, including a discussion with the highly regarded addiction care specialist, Dr. Hannah Statz DeVries.
We now know about the danger of fentanyl in every illicit drug out there. Yet, people continue to do illicit drugs. And some people even seek fentanyl now. How often are you hearing about something like that?
Daily.
Daily.
Yeah.
Can you explain it? Like, I know something has a chance to kill you, and pretty good chance. Can you explain how the brain is working or what is happening with that person?
So what I've seen, people not even seeking fentanyl, there's fentanyl that's getting laced into just drugs, whether it be cannabis and others. And, you know, I've seen this even in some of the recent articles that you've written, that we know that this is a problem. What the dealers and people who are on the supply side of this know is if they can get someone hooked, then that person is going to come back for more and they're going to want it from that dealer. So sometimes it's an inadvertent, hey, you know, I started using and now this is what I need. And hey, it's actually fentanyl at this point. And that dopamine release, that trigger and that disease pathway, it just takes over. And it becomes, that's what people want. And that's the disease clouding their judgment because the pleasure limbic center in the middle part of their brain has fully taken over that decision making, that judgment, that frontal part of your brain.
It's hard for people who don't suffer from substance use disorder to understand.
It is.
It's so hard to understand.
And that's that recovery that can take up to 2 years to really be back to a good baseline.
Meanwhile, Natasha says recovery wasn't easy. In fact, the first few days were more difficult than she anticipated.
And I was in the detox period and I almost left. I didn't think anything could get worse. I didn't think anything could get better with how bad it was.
How bad was it?
I lost a lot of weight. So I lost, I think, 25 pounds.
In a short period of time.
Like 2 weeks. Like my skin was breaking out. I was sweating all the time. I couldn't eat anything. I felt like I was dying. I felt like my body was on fire. I couldn't think straight. All I wanted was to get high. I had never wanted something so badly. I wouldn't wish that feeling in the way that it felt being in the detox part of it on anybody. It was horrible.
You got through it.
But I did. I got through
it. How did you get through it?
The Avera Addiction Care Center has a great team of nurses and staff, but really it was the people that I was in there with. And I remember when I was out of the detox portion and I joined the group, so to say, for the first time, this girl who was so bright and so cheery and so just full of life is like, I'm going to go show you all of the things and like, we're going to get through this together. And this is when it gets better. And I was exhausted. I was ready. I was so ready to give up. And every part of me didn't like her in that moment because she was so bright and cheerful and positive. So then I started going to groups and I started hearing about other people, people who had been where I was. And I realized that while I felt so alone, I wasn't at all. And there were people that knew what I was going through. There were people that had gotten better. There were people that wanted to do better. And that was the first time in my life that anybody had acknowledged that it was a disease. That it wasn't something that I could just stop. That it wasn't just a choice that I was making every day. And there were people that felt that pain and that had been through that suffering with me. It was a different feeling. I had people in my life who loved me and were like, we want you to get better. But nobody had actually walked beside me with it, through it. And that was the first time that somebody had acknowledged that my pain was real.
But just as Natasha saw the light at the end of the dark addiction tunnel, another curveball came her way. She found herself abruptly terminated from her job, leaving her without any insurance. She says this happened even though her boss was initially very supportive.
I told her that I wanted to go to inpatient treatment, that I had called my insurance, I had talked to my therapist, I had even talked to some of my coworkers about picking up some of my slack and things like that. And at first she was super supportive. She was like, yeah, like we'll even pay for it, all for it. And I was about halfway through my treatment.
You were in treatment.
I was in treatment, actively in treatment. And my therapist is like, hey, I need to talk to you. And I was like, what's up? And they were like, so there's something weird going on with your insurance. And I was like, okay. So I just happened to call my insurance and they were like, your policy was canceled. And I was like, for what? I had spoken to my employer. I had told them what I was doing. I had been very clear with them. They had told me that they would cover the insurance premium up front and that it would just be taken out of my paycheck when I return, that we would figure it out. not to worry about it. And so I reached out to one of my coworkers and I was like, hey, like, did you guys switch insurance? Like, what's going on? And she's like, no, but we all noticed that your name was taken off of our email list. And I was like, oh, okay. So I reached out to my boss and my boss was like, unfortunately, you're no longer employed here. They had met as a team, the supervisors, and had decided that because I hadn't been upfront during my addiction, that I could no longer be employed there. That, like, my addiction just went against their values.
And you found out you were fired while you're in treatment.
Yeah. So I was officially fired 10 days after I went to treatment. Nobody told me. I got a letter in the mail. And when somebody had brought my mail while I was in treatment, all the letter said was that I was no longer employed. And so when I had reached out to them, they were like, unfortunately, with your addiction. And I explained to them, I was like, I am making those efforts. I'm moving forward. And you guys wouldn't have even known if I didn't tell you. And I talked about how I thought things like that were protected. And they were simply like, unfortunately, you no longer work here. That was the end of it.
Fortunately, that's when an Emily's Hope Treatment Scholarship stepped in to provide a lifeline. Since December of 2019, Emily's Hope has contributed $350,000 towards scholarships, extending aid to hundreds of people ranging in age from 19 to 70.
I had actually talked about leaving.
Leaving treatment.
I was 17 days into my treatment, into 28-day treatment. I had done all of the really hard work. I had gotten clean. I was testing that the drugs were out of my system. But I hadn't gotten to the part where I got to focus on me. I had done all the hard work of repairing the relationships, doing the steps, things like that. But I hadn't gotten to the point of how I was going to be clean outside of treatment. And I went to my therapist and I told him that I didn't think I could be there anymore because I couldn't afford it. So after talking to a couple of people, it was when the Emily's Hope scholarship was brought in and they covered that payment of my insurance premium to allow my insurance to continue to pay for that final month that I was in treatment.
For a person suffering substance use disorder, finishing the program can be the difference between recovery and relapse. It could also be the difference between life and death. After a period of sobriety, using drugs again can be especially dangerous. We talked about that in a previous Grieving Out Loud episode with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
They go out and maybe use their usual dose, take the same size pill or, you know, the same bag of heroin, and they're at risk now because they've lost their tolerance for overdose and death. And so the rate of death is astronomically high.
So if I hadn't gotten the Emily's Hope scholarship, I would have left. I would have left treatment, and I don't think I would have stayed sober. I think looking back at it now, the work that I did in that final few days there was life-changing. And being able to find the resources, and because towards the end of your treatment, that's what you do, is you look for the resources and you look for the things that can help you and how you're going to stay sober. And I actually found out afterwards that if I would have left, my insurance wouldn't have covered any of my stay because they don't cover it if you leave early. So I would have ended up paying for the entire portion out of pocket. So just knowing that I don't have that financial burden and that, you know, I have a roof over my head and things like that is life-changing. And it saved my life.
The scholarship not only enabled Natasha to complete her treatment, it also allowed her to focus on her recovery once she left the facility.
So then having insurance also paid for the medication that I needed leaving, because that was the other thing that I had really stressed about was, you know, I've taken these steps and I've done the work, but we can't do it all on our own.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
And then you got your prescriptions filled.
And then it also paid for my next month of therapy. So all of the things that we talk about when you leave treatment, I was going to therapy 4 times a week at that point. I was checking with my therapist every day. I was seeing my psychiatrist weekly at that point. And all of those things I wouldn't have been able to do without that insurance coverage.
Natasha is extremely grateful for the financial support she received during her recovery. However, she believes there is still significant progress to be made in acknowledging substance use disorder as a disease. This is especially true in the context of insurance companies providing coverage for essential medications.
While I was in detox, they started giving me Suboxone. And I don't know what it's like recovering without it, but I know that it made it easier. And it was something that I discussed at length with my provider before agreeing to take it. I wanted to be clean. And at that point, I had made the commitment to be clean. And so I kind of talked to my doctor about it. And the cost was the only thing that I struggled with. So my insurance covered it. And then once I lost my insurance after that month was up and got new insurance, my insurance didn't cover it anymore. But while I was taking it, I didn't feel the cravings. I feel like I was able to really focus on finding a job and finding these things and changing my life versus focusing on those cravings day in and day out all of the time.
But you weren't able to stay on it.
Yeah, with the cost. So it would have cost $750. So for the first 8 months, I was paying the $750 out of pocket to take it. But because it's so expensive and a lot of insurance don't cover it because they consider it unnecessary drug. I don't remember exactly how they classified it when I was asking my insurance why they wouldn't cover it, but it came down to it was an elective medicine. And it wasn't one that had any scientific proof of it helping anything. After talking to my doctors, we were weaned off of it and I stopped taking it.
How upsetting is that to you?
It's frustrating. It's a medication that helps people, and I truly and genuinely have felt the effects of it helping. And I think that if it was more accessible, I think we'd have a lot less people who are in active addiction.
Do you feel like you may relapse because you don't have access to that medication?
I think it's a potential. I don't think I personally will, but through my work and through people that I've met, I know people who have stopped taking it because they just can't afford it and they don't have any way to get it and have relapsed. And have talked about once they started that medication again, that they didn't have those triggers and those feelings of needing opioids anymore.
So we need to change something here. What do we need to change?
It needs to be affordable. It needs to be something that insurance covers. And we pay however much money a month for insurance. And then for them to not cover something that's life-saving medicine is ridiculous.
And Natasha knows firsthand how it can truly be life-saving. Over the past year, she's lost 6 friends to drugs. Yes, 6 friends in 1 year. 4 of them died from fentanyl.
When you think about these people that you've lost, 6 in a year?
Yeah. It's tough. And it's one of those things where if treatment was as accessible as the drugs, I don't think I would have lost anybody this year. And not knowing where to turn, not knowing who to go to. And I've had people who tell me that they walked into a doctor's office asking for help and that the doctor turned them away and said that we don't do that here. You know, you need to go see somebody else. But what people don't understand is how big of a step that is. How to go from being an active addiction to being like, hi, I need help.
What keeps you in recovery now?
Yeah, so after getting out of treatment, my therapist recommended that I tried yoga. I did all of the things. I went to the AA meetings and the NA meetings and all of those things. And I just didn't feel like I belonged. I felt like I was so different from everybody that was in the group. And it just wasn't the community that I was looking for. And so my therapist recommended that I try yoga. And I went to a yoga class and I fell in love with it. It was everything that I felt like I was missing. And then one day I was talking to a friend and my friend was like, you know, you do yoga. And I was like, yeah, you should come with me. And so a couple of us went and I decided that I wanted to have a yoga group specifically for people in recovery. I wanted a place where people could come and be authentic and share their feelings and connect with their minds and their bodies. Because when you're doing drugs, you talk about this numb feeling. And that's why people do drugs, because they don't want to feel anymore. And now you have this practice of yoga that's bringing back that feeling and allowing you that connection. So I started this group. It started as a couple of us in my garage. We would meet once a week in my garage. I started realizing that there were more and more people that could benefit from this. So we eventually moved to an actual yoga studio, which is kind of where my passion for helping people specifically in addiction recovery came from. I couldn't have done it alone. The people that were in my life, whether they were personal or professional, the strangers that I met, it's such a tight-knit community in such a great way. There's the accountability, there's somebody there. And so just being able to give back to people what I think keeps me sober every day.
Natasha's yoga group, known as the Recovery Common, offers a unique blend of yoga and recovery meetings. These classes focus on restorative or yin yoga, characterized by slow-paced sessions that incorporate supported poses.
One of the big things that we stress is that we help people find treatment options. A lot of times people don't know where to turn to. I was fortunate enough that I had two great therapists that knew exactly where to go. But if I had to do it on my own, I would have had no idea who to turn to, where to go. I had even called my insurance to see like who they covered. And they were like, I don't know, like find somebody and let us know. And we'll tell you if we cover their services or not. I was like, well, if I want an eye doctor, I can call and you'll tell me the closest eye doctor. But really what our goal is to just provide a safe space for people to feel those feelings, be their authentic selves, and accept that addiction is something that you'll live the rest of your life with. Whether you're in active addiction or you're in recovery, those feelings don't go away. And things like Suboxone and yoga and different vitamins and supplements and counseling and things like that are all ways that you can help yourself. And so when we come together collectively and do those things, we've seen that people do better. They recover better.
Connection.
And they connect with each other and they connect with themselves.
Natasha also hopes that by sharing her story, she's helping to break down the stigma surrounding substance use disorder. She wants to let people know they're not alone in this battle. And there's absolutely no shame in reaching out for help when you need it.
Your typical addiction stigma isn't real. It's not just people living under bridges and people being homeless. It's people that you meet in your everyday life. It's doctors and lawyers and nurses and therapists and people who are just regular people. I think it's important that we share and that we bring recognition to it and to know that it's not something to be ashamed of. If I had a different disease, I would, you know, get that help and that support from my friends and my family and things like that. And I think we need to look at addiction the same way.
Speaking of support, Natasha says she'll be forever grateful for those who generously donated their money to make her Emily's Hope Treatment Scholarship available.
Definitely life-changing. I think knowing that there's programs whose sole purposes are to help people that are in recovery and knowing that people that might not have the financial resources to get the treatment that they need and that can get the help that they need and can go on to live perfect, healthy lives. I think so often when we talk about addiction, we're looking at each person as an addict. And I think it's time that we start looking at people as people and to know that it could be, you know, your brother, your sister, your neighbor, your doctor could be struggling with something. And knowing that there's programs whose sole purpose is to help people is truly life-changing.
And if you'd like to help in changing someone's life, please check out this podcast show notes. We also appreciate you taking the time to listen to this episode and learn more about a topic that often remains in the shadows. If you found this podcast helpful, please consider sharing it with friends and family and giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage. This podcast is produced by Casey Wannenberg-King and Anna Fye.